intelligent, but the sadness in it is engrafted into the intelligence, so to speak, until they seem one thing. I believe there is a dignity in sorrow simply because it is God's good pleasure that there should be. He is forever raising up those who are brought low. This does not mean that it is ever right to cause suffering or to seek it out when it can be avoided. It serves no good practical purpose. To value suffering in itself can be dangerous and strange, so I want to be very clear about this. It means simply that God takes the side of sufferers against those who afflict it. I hope you are familiar with the prophets, particularly Isaiah. Now, your mother never talks about herself, really, and she never admits to having felt any sort of grief in her life at all. That's her courage, her pride, and I know you will be respectful of it. And remember at the same time that a very, very great gentleness is called for, a great kindness, because no one ever has that sort of courage who hasn't needed it. But you might not realize that when you are young. I have often worried a little about the way the people in the church act toward her. She is distant, but she can't help that. So they are distant, too. On the other hand, I have often thought that she and I are well suited, no matter how we appear, because I have seen enough of life to understand her. They are not unkind, and they will give her whatever help she will accept. But most of them cannot see her youth in her as I do. I believe she may even seem a little hard to them. I have written a letter to her with instructions. I will add this to it. I have given money to people over the years, not a large amount, but a fair portion of my salary. Generally, I made up stories about forgotten funds and anonymous donations. Whether most of them believe me, I doubt. At the time, I had no idea that I would ever have a wife or a child, so I didn't think much about it, as I have said. I didn't keep any record, and I have no certain memory of individuals or circumstances. I have also paid for things around the church, paint and window panes and so on. We had some bleak times when I couldn't bring myself to ask anyone to provide what I could provide myself. I say this only because I want you to know that any help you receive, even to a fairly substantial amount, may be thought of by you not as charity, but as repayment. I have never thought of the congregation as being in my debt, but the fact is that I have cast considerable bread upon those waters, and whatever bread returns, you will be receiving as from my own hand, by the grace of God, of course. But I wish to say certain things about the fifth commandment, and why it should be thought of as belonging to the first tablet. Briefly, the right worship of God is essential, because it forms the mind to a right understanding of God. God is set apart. He is one. He is not to be imagined as a thing among things. Idolatry, that is what Feuerbach failed to grasp. His name is set apart. It is sacred, which I take to be a reflection of the sacredness of the word, the creative utterance, which is not of a kind with other language. Then the Sabbath is set apart from other days for the enjoyment of time and duration, perhaps, over and above the creatures who inhabit time. Because the beginning, which might be called the seed of time, is the condition for all the creation that follows. Then mother and father are set apart, you see. It seems to me almost a retelling of creation. First there is the Lord, then the Word, then the day, then the man and woman, and after that Cain and Abel. Thou shalt not kill. All the sins recorded in those prohibitions, just as crimes are recorded in the laws against them. So perhaps the tablets differ as addressing the eternal and the temporal. What the reading yields is the idea of father and mother as the universal father and mother, the Lord's dear Adam and his beloved Eve, that is, essential humankind as it came from his hand. There's a pattern in these commandments of setting things apart so that their holiness will be perceived. Every day is holy, but the Sabbath is set apart so that the holiness of time can be experienced. Every human being is worthy of honor. But the conscious discipline of honor is learned from this setting apart of the father and mother, who usually labor and are heavy laden and may be cranky or stingy or ignorant or overbearing. Believe me, I know this can be a hard commandment to keep. But I believe also that the rewards of obedience are great, because at the root of real honor is always the sense of the sacredness of the person who is its object. In the particular instance of your mother, I know that if you are attentive to her in this way, you will find a very great loveliness in her. When you love someone to the degree you love her, you see her as God sees her. And that is an instruction in the nature of God and humankind and of being itself. That is why the fifth commandment belongs on the first tablet. I have persuaded myself of it. I slept decently. I stay at home Mondays when I can, my day of rest. So I had the morning to think and pray and also do a little reshelving. And while I was doing that, it came to my mind that I should consider what I would say to myself if I came to myself for counsel. In fact, I do that all the time, as any rational person does. But there is a tendency in my thinking for the opposed sides of a question to cancel each other more or less algebraically. This is true, but on the other hand, so is that. So I discover a kind of equivalency of considerations that is interesting in itself, but resolves nothing. If I put my thinking down on paper, perhaps I can think more rigorously. Where a resolution is necessary, it must also be possible. Not deciding is really one of the two choices that are available to me, so decision must be allowed its moment, too. That is, as behavior, not deciding to act would be identical with deciding not to act. If I were to put deciding not to act at one end of a continuum of possibility and deciding to act at the other end, the whole intervening space would be given over to not deciding, which would mean not acting. I believe this makes sense. My point, in any case, is that I must put special corrective emphasis on the possibility of doing the thing I dread doing, which is telling your mother what I think I ought to tell her. Question. What is it you feel most, Moriturus? Answer. I, Moriturus, fear leaving my wife and child unknowingly in the sway of a man of extremely questionable character. Question. What makes you think his contact with them or his influence upon them will be considerable enough to be damaging to them? Now, that really is an excellent question, and one I would not have thought to put to myself. The answer would be, he has come by the house a few times. He has come to church once. Not an impressive reply. The truth is, as I stood there in the pulpit, looking down on the three of you, you looked to me like a handsome young family. And my evil old heart rose within me. The old covetous I have mentioned elsewhere came over me, and I felt the way I used to feel when the beauty of other lives was a misery and an offense to me, and I felt as if I were looking back from the grave. Well, thank God I thought that through. And while I am being honest, I will add here that for perhaps 2 months I have felt a certain change in the way people act toward me, which could be a simple reflex of the way I act toward them. Maybe I don't understand as much as I should. Maybe I don't make as much sense as I should. The fact is, I don't want to be old, and I certainly don't want to be dead. I don't want to be the tremulous old coot you barely remember. I bitterly wish you could know me as a young man, and not really so young, either, necessarily. I was trim and fit into my 60s. That was the one way I took after my grandfather and my father. I was never rangy like them, but I was very strong, very sound. Even now, if I could trust my heart, there's a lot I could do. I don't have to fault myself for feeling this way. The Lord wept in the garden on the night he was betrayed, as I have said to people in my situation many times. So it isn't just some unredeemed paganism in me that I dread what I should welcome, though clearly my sorrow is alloyed with discreditable emotion, emotions of other kinds. Of course, of course. Who will free me from the body of this death? Well, I know the answer to that one. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye. I imagine a kind of ecstatic pirouette, a little bit like going up for a line drive when you're so young that your body almost doesn't know about effort. Paul couldn't have meant something entirely different from that. So there's that to look forward to. I say this because I really feel as though I'm failing, and not primarily in the medical sense. And I feel as if I am being left out, as though I'm a straggler and people can't quite remember to stay back for me. I had a dream like that last night. I was Boughton in the dream, for all purposes. Poor old Boughton. This morning you came to me with a picture you had made that you wanted me to admire. I was just at the end of a magazine article, just finishing the last paragraph, so I didn't look up right away. Your mother said, in the kindest, saddest voice, "He doesn't hear you." Not "he didn't," but "he doesn't." That article was very interesting. It was in Ladies' Home Journal, an old issue Glory found in her father's study and brought over for me to look at. There was a note on it, "Show Ames." But it ended up at the bottom of a stack of things, I guess because it's from 1948. The article is called "God and the American People," and it says 95% of us say we believe in God. But our religion doesn't meet the writer's standards, not at all. To his mind, all those people in all those churches are the scribes and the Pharisees. He seems to me to be a bit of a scribe himself, scorning and rebuking the way he does. How do you tell a scribe from a prophet? Which is what he clearly takes himself to be. The prophets love the people they chastise, a thing this writer does not appear to me to do. The oddness of the phrase "believe in God" brings to my mind the first chapter of Feuerbach, which is really about the awkwardness of language, not about religion at all. Feuerbach doesn't imagine the possibility of an existence beyond this one, by which I mean a reality embracing this one but exceeding it, the way, for example, the world embraces and exceeds Soapy's understanding of it. Soapy might be a victim of ideological conflict right along with the rest of us if things get out of hand. She would no doubt make some feline appraisal of the situation, which would have nothing to do with the dictatorship of the proletariat or the Manhattan Project. The inadequacy of her concepts would have nothing to do with the reality of the situation. That's a drastic way of putting it, and not a very precise one. I don't wish to suggest a reality that is simply an enlarged or extrapolated version of this reality. If you think how a thing we call a stone differs from a thing we call a dream, the degrees of unlikeness within the reality we know are very extreme. And what I wish to suggest is a much more absolute unlikeness with which we exist, though our human circumstance creates in us a radically limited and peculiar notion of what existence is. I gave a sermon on this once, the text being, Your thoughts are not our thoughts. That was a good deal longer than 2 months ago. I believe it was last year. I thought at the time it might have puzzled a few people, but I was pleased with it. I even wished Edward could have heard it. I felt I'd clarified some things. I remember one lady did ask me, as she was going out the door, "Who is Feuerbach?" And that made me aware of that tendency of mine to live too much in my own thoughts. Your mother wanted to name the cat Feuerbach, but you insisted on Soapy. It could be true that my interest in abstractions, which would have been forgiven first on grounds of youth and then on grounds of eccentricity, is now being forgiven on grounds of senility, which would mean people have stopped trying to see the sense in the things I say the way they once did. That would be by far the worst form of forgiveness. I used to have one of those books with humorous little sermon anecdotes in it somewhere. It was a gift, I remembered, no name on it. How many years ago did I get that? I've probably been boring a lot of people for a long time. Strange to find comfort in the idea. There have always been things I felt I must tell them, even if no one listened or understood. And one of them is that many of the attacks on beliefs that have had such prestige for the last century or two are in fact meaningless. I must tell you this, because everything else I have told you, and them, loses almost all its meaning and its right to attention if this is not established. If I were to go through my old sermons, I might find some in which I deal with this subject. Since I am presumably somewhere near the end of my time and my strength, that might be the best way to make the case for you. I should have thought of this long ago. This afternoon we walked over to Boughton's to return his magazine. You held my hand a fair part of the way. There were milkweed seeds drifting around which you had to try to catch, but you'd come back and take my hand again. It's a hard thing to be patient with me, the way I creep along these days, but I'm trying not to get my heart in a state. There have been so many fine days this summer that I've begun to hear talk of a drought. Dust and grasshoppers are fine in their way, too, within limits. Whatever is coming, I'd be sorry to miss it. Boughton was on his porch, listening to the breeze, he said, feeling the breeze. Glory brought out some lemonade for us and sat down with us, and we talked a little bit about television. Your mother has been looking at it, too. I don't enjoy it myself. It's not the last impression I want to have of this world. It turns out that when Glory found that article and asked her father if he still wanted me to see it, he asked her to read it over to him. And then he laughed and said, "Oh, yes, yes, Reverend Ames will want to have a look at that." He knows what will exasperate me, and he was laughing in anticipation as soon as I mentioned it. We agreed it must have been fairly widely read in both our congregations, because on one page there's a recipe for that molded salad of orange gelatin with stuffed green olives and shredded cabbage and anchovies that has dogged my ministerial life these last years, and which appears at his house whenever he so much as catches cold. There should be a law to prevent recipes for molded salad from appearing within 20 pages of any article having to do with religion. I ended up bringing the magazine back home because I thought I might want to use it in a sermon. There are two insidious notions from the point of view of Christianity in the modern world. No doubt there are more than two, but the others will have to wait. One is that religion and religious experience are illusions of some sort, Feuerbach, Freud, etc., and the other is that religion itself is real, but your belief that you participate in it is an illusion. I think the second of these is the more insidious, because it is religious experience above all that authenticates religion for the purposes of the individual believer. But people of any degree of religious sensitivity are always vulnerable to the accusation that their consciousness or their understanding does not attain to the highest standards of the faith, because that is always true of everyone. St. Paul is eloquent on this subject. But if the awkwardness and falseness and failure of religion are interpreted to mean there is no core of truth in it, and the witness of Scripture from end to end discourages this view, then people are disabled from trusting their thoughts, their expressions of belief, and their understanding, and even from believing in the essential dignity of their and their neighbor's endlessly flawed experience of belief. It seems to me there is less meanness in atheism, by a good measure. It seems that the spirit of religious self-righteousness this article deplores is precisely the spirit in which it is written. Of course, he's right about many things, one of them being the destructive potency of religious self-righteousness. Here is a sentence Boughton and I got a laugh out of. One might ask how many Christians can define Christianity. In 25 volumes or less, I said. Boughton said, fewer, and winked at Glory, and she said, ever the stickler, which is true. Of course, I was simply using contemporary idiom, and he was aware of that. He just doesn't approve of it. I don't use it often, but I think it's perfectly fine for making a little joke now and then. Here is a paragraph we lingered over. There is indeed a note of sinful pride in the confidence with which the majority of people express their ideas about heaven. For although the Bible has much to say about final judgment, it offers no definitive picture of life after death. Yet fewer than one-third of the American people, 29%, admit they have no ideas on what is one of the most ambiguous subjects in biblical revelation. Now, that is a kind of interpretation I would call fraudulent. To say a subject is ambiguous is not to say one cannot form ideas on it, or shouldn't, nor is it to say even that it is possible to avoid forming ideas on it. Any concept that exists in the mind at all exists in some form, among some set of associations. I'd like to talk to that 29% who have no ideas to see how they do it. I bet they just didn't like the question. Boughton says he has more ideas about heaven every day. He said, mainly, I just think about the splendors of the world and multiply by two. I'd multiply by 10 or 12 if I had the energy, but 2 is much more than sufficient for my purposes. So he's just sitting there, multiplying the feel of the wind by 2, multiplying the smell of the grass by 2. I remember when we put that old wagon on the courthouse roof, he said. Seems to me the stars were brighter in those days, twice as bright, and we were twice as clever. Oh, more than that, he said. Much more than that. Jack came out and sat down with us. He asked if he could look at the article, and I gave it to him. He said, I thought he made the point in here somewhere that Americans' treatment of the Negro indicated a lack of religious seriousness. Boughton said, it is very easy to judge. Jack smiled and handed the magazine back to me. True, he said. That was the first I'd seen of him since Sunday, since the service. He went out through the chancel and the side door to avoid shaking hands with me, I believe. I've been feeling some discomfort on that account, as well as others. I was even a little embarrassed to meet his eyes, to tell the truth. I believe returning the magazine was mainly a pretext for looking in on Boughton and Glory to see if they were upset with me. I wasn't done with that article. I meant all along to bring it back with me. I conceal my motives from myself pretty effectively sometimes. I even imagined, lying awake Sunday night, that Jack might go away again because I had brought up the old catastrophe right there in church, or so he seemed to believe. I thought of apologizing, but that would only confirm in his mind that my meaning and my intention were what he took them to be, which I do not wholly believe. and which would deprive him of the possibility of making a less damaging interpretation of them. At any rate, it would raise the issue between us, perhaps unnecessarily. Finally, I was hesitant to go to the house at all, fearing that my mere presence might be an irritant or a provocation, as I feared my staying away might be also. Then Glory came by to say hello. She seemed in fine spirits, and I was mightily relieved. If there is one thing I don't want to do in the time that remains to either of us, it is offend Boughton. I fell to thinking what a pleasure it must be to him to have Jack there, and it occurred to me that it might be a remarkable generosity on Jack's part to come home to the poor old man, and perhaps to Glory also, considering her troubles. I was downright ashamed to remember how impatient I was for him to leave, thinking only of my own life, I admit. The thought had even occurred to me that he might be there to start moving his father out of the house, so to speak, since he and the other children will inherit it. The place really did need to be put right, and there was much more to do than Glory could have done alone. Sitting there on the porch with Jack, I was struck by how much he had aged. Of course, he's old enough to have aged. He's in his 40s somewhere. Angeline would be 51, so he's 43. There's gray in his hair, and he looks tired around the eyes. Well, he looked tense, as he always does, and he also looked sad, it seemed to me. Your mother came up the road to tell us our supper was ready. It was a cold supper, she said, so there was no hurry. She agreed to sit with us for a few minutes. She always has to be coaxed to stay in company even a little while, and then it's all I can do to get a word from her. I believe she worries about the way she talks. I love the way she talks, or the way she talked when I first knew her. It don't matter, she would say in that low, soft voice of hers. That was what she said when she meant she forgave someone. But it had a sound of deeper, sadder resignation, as if she were forgiving the whole of the created order, forgiving the Lord himself. It grieves me that I may never hear just those words spoken by her again. I believe Boughton made herself conscious with that little trick of his of correcting people. Not that he ever corrected her. It don't matter. It was as if she were renouncing the world itself, just in order to make nothing of some offense to her. Such a prodigal renunciation, that empty-handed prodigality I remember from the old days. I have nothing to give you. Take and eat. Ashy biscuit, summer rain, her hair falling wet around her face. If I were to multiply the splendors of the world by two, the splendors as I feel them, I would arrive at an idea of heaven very unlike anything you see in the old paintings. So Jack Boughton is 43. I have no idea what sort of life he has had since he left here. There has never been any mention of marriage or children or of any particular kind of work. I always felt it was best not to inquire. I was sitting there listening to old Boughton ramble along. He uses the expression himself, about a trip he and his wife made once to Minneapolis, when Jack broke in and said to me, "So, Reverend, I would like to hear your views on the doctrine of predestination." Now that is probably my least favorite topic of conversation in the entire world. I have spent a great deal of my life hearing that doctrine talked up and down, and no one's understanding ever advanced one iota. I've seen grown men, God-fearing men, come to blows over that doctrine. The first thought that came to my mind was, of course he would bring up predestination. So I said, "That's a complicated issue." "Let me simplify it," he said. "Do you think some people are intentionally and irretrievably consigned to perdition?" "Well," I said, "that may actually be the kind of simplification that raises more questions than it avoids." He laughed. "People must ask you about this all the time," he said. "They do." Then I suppose you must have some way of responding. I tell them there are certain attributes our faith assigns to God. Omniscience, omnipotence, justice, and grace. We human beings have such a slight acquaintance with power and knowledge, so little conception of justice, and so slight a capacity for grace, that the workings of these great attributes together is a mystery we cannot hope to penetrate. He laughed. You say it in those very words? Yes, I do, more or less those very words. It's a fraught question, and I'm careful with it. He nodded. I take you to mean that you do believe in predestination. I dislike that word. It's been put to crude uses. Can you propose a better word? Not offhand. I felt he was deviling me, you see. I would like your help with this, Reverend, he said, so seriously that I began to think he might be serious. This is a grave issue, isn't it? We're not really dealing here with a mere word, a mere abstraction. You're right, I said. That's true. I assume predestination does not, in your understanding, mean that a good person will go to hell simply because he was consigned to hell from the beginning. Glory said, Excuse me, I've heard this argument 1,000 times, and I hate it. Old Boughton said, I hate this conversation a good deal myself, and I've never seen it go anywhere. I wouldn't really call this an argument, though, Glory. Wait 5 minutes, she said. She got up and walked into the house, but your mother sat still, listening. Jack said, I'm the amateur here. I suppose if I had your history with the question, I'd be sick of it too. Well, actually, I believe I do have a history with it. I have had reason to wonder fairly often about it. I hoped you would instruct me a little. I don't believe a person can be good in any meaningful sense and also be consigned to perdition. Nor do I believe that a person who is sinful in any sense is necessarily consigned to perdition. Scripture clearly says otherwise in both cases. I'm sure it does. But are there people who are simply born evil, live evil lives, and then go to hell? On that point, Scripture is not so clear. What does your own experience suggest, Reverend? Generally, a person's behavior is consistent with his nature, which is only to say his behavior is consistent. The consistency is what I mean when I speak of his nature. I recognized a redundancy there, a circularity. He smiled. People don't change, then? He said. They do if there is some other factor involved, drink or some sort of personal influence. That is, their behavior changes. Whether that means their nature changes or that another aspect of it becomes visible is hard to say. He said, For a man of the cloth, you're pretty cagey. That made old Boughton laugh. You should have seen him 30 years ago. I did. Well, his father said, you should have been paying attention. Jack shrugged. I was. Now that got to me a little. I don't know why Boughton would have led him on like that. Cagey at checkers, maybe. I said, I'm just trying to find a slightly useful way of saying there are things I don't understand. I'm not going to force some theory on a mystery and make foolishness of it, just because that is what people who talk about it normally do. Your mother looked at me, so I knew I must have sounded upset. I was upset. 9/10 of the time when some smart aleck starts in on theological questions, he's only trying to put me in a false position, and I'm just too old to see the joke in it anymore. Then Glory came to the door and said, Your 5 minutes aren't up yet, as if anyone needed to underscore the futility. But your mother spoke up, which surprised us all. She said, What about being saved? She said, If you can't change, there don't seem much purpose in it. She blushed. That's not what I meant. You've made an excellent point, dear, Boughton said. I worried a long time about how the mystery of predestination could be reconciled with the mystery of salvation. I remember thinking about that a great deal. No conclusions? Jack asked. None that I can remember. Then he said, To conclude is not in the nature of the enterprise. Jack smiled at your mother as if he was looking for an ally, someone to share his frustration, but she just sat there very still and studied her hands. I should think, he said, that the question Mrs. Ames has raised is one you gentlemen would approach with great seriousness. I know you have attended tent meetings only as interested observers, but, excuse me, I don't believe anyone else wants to pursue this, so I'll let it go. Your mother said, I'm interested. Old Barton, who was getting a little ruffled, said, I hope the Presbyterian Church is as good a place as any to learn the blessed truths of the faith, including redemption and salvation, first of all. The Lord knows I have labored to make it so. Pardon me, Father, Jack said. I'll go find Glory. She'll tell me how to make myself useful. You always said that was the best way to keep out of trouble. No, stay, your mother said. And he did. There was an uneasy silence, so I remarked that he might find Carl Barth a help, just for the sake of conversation. He said, Is that what you do when some tormented soul arrives on your doorstep at midnight? Recommend Carl Barth? I said, It depends on the case, which it does. I have found Barth's work to be full of comfort, as I believe I have told you elsewhere. But in fact, I don't recall ever recommending him to any tormented soul except my own. That is what I meant about being put in a false position. Your mother said, A person can change. Everything can change. Still never looking at him. He said, Thanks. That's all I wanted to know. So that was the end of the conversation. We went home to supper. I was left wondering what he was referring to when he mentioned tent meetings. And I have thought a lot about that word cagey. I have always dreaded having to talk theology with people who have no sympathy for it. I've been evasive from time to time, that's true. I see the error of assuming a person is not speaking with you in good faith. It's not respectful, I know that, and I don't do it often. Nor do I have the occasion to around here, where it seems as if I baptized half the people I pass on the street and taught them all the theology they will ever know. But it is hard for me to see good faith in John Ames Boughton. And that's a terrible problem. As we were walking home, your mother said, He was only asking a question, which was almost a rebuke coming from her. Then after we'd walked a little farther, she said, Maybe some people aren't so comfortable with themselves. Now that was a rebuke, and she was quite right. What need had an old soldier like me to defend himself, even from mockery, if that was what he was up to? There was no question of need, there was only habit. I believe I have tried never to say anything Edward would have found callow or naive. That constraint has been useful to me, in my opinion. It may be a form of defensiveness, but I hope it has at least been useful on balance. There is a tendency among some religious people even to invite ridicule and to bring down on themselves an intellectual contempt, which seems to me in some cases justified. Nevertheless, I would advise you against defensiveness on principle. It precludes the best eventualities along with the worst. At the most basic level, it expresses a lack of faith. As I have said, the worst eventualities can have great value as experience. And often enough, when we think we are protecting ourselves, we are struggling against our rescuer. I know this. I have seen the truth of it with my own eyes, though I have not myself always managed to live by it. The good Lord knows. I truly doubt I would know how to live by it for even a day or an hour. That is a remarkable thing to consider. I believe it will put my mind at ease to tell you straightforwardly what is at issue here. Sleep has become a great problem, elusive, and then pretty grueling when it comes. prayer has not been equal to quieting these perturbations. If I feel that what I tell you is untrue in some way, or that I simply ought not to tell it, I can just destroy these pages. They certainly won't be the first I've destroyed. Back when I had a wood stove, it was a satisfyingly easy thing to do. There was a rightness to seeing nonsense and frustration fall into the flames. I'm thinking we should have somebody build us a barbecue, like the Mullers did. Let me say, first of all, that the grace of God is sufficient to any transgression, and that to judge is wrong, the origin and essence of much error and cruelty. I am aware of these things, as I hope you are also. Let me say, too, that there are bonds which oblige me to special tolerance and kindness towards this young man, John Ames Boughton. He is the beloved child of my oldest and dearest friend who gave him to me, so to speak, to compensate for my own childlessness. I baptized him in Boughton's congregation. I remember the moment very clearly. Boughton and Mrs. Boughton and all the little ones there at the font, watching to see my joyful surprise, which I hope they did see, because my feelings at the time were a little more complex than I'd have wished. I had not been warned. All this being the case, it offends my conscience to bear witness against him. Nevertheless, there is a very real sense in which people are fairly and appropriately associated with their histories for human purposes. To say a thief is a brother man and beloved of God is true. To say, therefore, a thief is not a thief is an error. I don't wish to imply that young Boughton ever, to the best of my knowledge, stole anything of significance in any conventional sense of the word stole. It is only to explain why I feel I may speak to you of his past, or at least of what little I know of it and what is to the point. As I said before, the basic circumstances themselves are so commonplace that they can be dealt with in a very few words. About 20 years ago, while he was still in college at any rate, he became involved with a young girl, and the involvement produced a child. This sort of thing happens, and it is sorted out one way or another, as any clergyman can tell you. In this instance, however, there were aggravating circumstances. For one thing, the girl was very young. For another, her family situation was desolate, even squalid. In other words, to say the least, she enjoyed none of the protections a young girl needs. How Jack Boughton even found her has never been clear to me. She and her family lived in an isolated house with a lot of mean dogs under the porch. It was a sad place, and she was a sad child. And there he was, with his college airs, and his letter sweater, and that Plymouth convertible he got somewhere for a song, he said, when he was asked about it. Boughton had so many children to educate, they all had to work, Jack too, and a car was out of the question even for old Boughton. His congregation gave him a used Buick in 1946, because by then it was too hard for him to walk anywhere. Jack Boughton had no business in the world involving himself with that girl. It was something no honorable man would have done. However I turn it over in my mind, that fact remains. And here is a prejudice of mine, confirmed by my lights through many years of observation. Sinners are not all dishonorable people, not by any means. But those who are dishonorable never really repent and never really reform. Now, I may be wrong here. No such distinction occurs in Scripture. And repentance and reformation are matters of the soul which only the Lord can judge. But in my experience, dishonor is recalcitrant. When I see it, my heart sinks, because I feel I have no help to offer a dishonorable person. I know the deficiency may be my own altogether. In any case, young Boughton never acknowledged the child to make any provision for it at all. He did tell his father about it, as if confessing a transgression, as his father saw it. though to me it seemed like pure meanness, because he must have known that grandchild would weigh on old Boughton's mind something terrible, as it did. He even told Boughton where the young girl lived, and Glory drove the old man out there in that foolish convertible. Boughton hoped to baptize the child. It was a little girl, or at least to satisfy himself that she would be baptized. But the people were hostile to him, as if he were the one at fault. So he left some money and went away, very dejected and humiliated. He was so obviously miserable that Mrs. Boughton made Glory tell her what the problem was, and then she was so miserable that Glory drove them both out in the country. Mrs. Boughton had to see the baby, and she had to hold her. It was probably unwise for her to do that. Well, I held her, too. Where wisdom could have found a place in a situation like that one, I don't claim to know. They brought diapers and clothes, and they left money. This went on for a long time. It went on for several years, in fact. Glory used to come to me and cry about it, because nothing ever got better. The baby was always too dirty and too small. She took me out to see the situation for myself, and I can tell you it was very bad. People have a right to live as they see fit, but that was no place for an infant. There were tin cans and broken glass all over the yard, and dirty old mattresses on the floor, and who knows what all. Dogs everywhere. How could young Boughton have taken advantage of that girl, and then to have abandoned her? Glory said when she asked her brother if he planned to marry the girl, he just said, "You've seen her." On the way there, Glory told me how I must try to persuade the family to let the girl and her baby come into town and live in a nice Christian family. I tried that, but her father spat on the floor and said, "She's already got a nice Christian family." Then all the way home, Glory described a plan she had come up with to kidnap the child. The baby, that is. She knew some stories about the old days when they used to smuggle fugitives up from Missouri, and she thought one small infant would be a much easier thing to conceal. Several houses in town have hidden cellars or cabinets where people could be put out of sight for a day or two. The church has one in the attic. I'll have to remember to show it to you. It will involve climbing a ladder. Well, we'll see. I told her that in the old days, towns like ours were a conspiracy. Lots of people were only there to be anti-slavery by any means that came to hand. Persuading someone to take a child from her mother to steal it was a very different thing, especially since Glory had no evidence of any claim on the child. She said she had written again and again to young Boughton, asking him to acknowledge the child for his parents' sake. She had washed the baby and dressed her up and sent him smiling photographs. She had photographed the baby in his father's arms. Jack sent Glory cards on her birthday and boxes of chocolate, and made no reference whatever to his child or to the misery he had caused in their household. She was crying so hard she had to pull off the road. "They're so sad," she said. "They're so ashamed." Young Boughton did have the decency to leave his convertible and take the train back to school so that Glory could drive her parents out to see that poor, croupy, rashy child every week or so. Well, here is the end of the story. The little girl lived about 3 years. She was turning into a spry, wiry little thing, a sort of sullen pride to her mother and her nice Christian family. But she cut her foot somehow, and died of the infection. The last time they visited her, they saw she was in bad shape. So Glory went and found a doctor, but by then there was nothing to be done. The grandfather said, "Her lot was very hard," and Glory slapped him. He threatened to press charges, but I guess he never got around to it. He let the Boughtons bury the little girl in their family plot, since they agreed to pay the expenses, and a little more besides. So there she is. The stone says, "Baby, 3 years." Her mother had never really settled on a name. And then, "Their angels in heaven always see the faces of my father in heaven." It is a bitter story, and left us all with much to regret. I suppose we really should have stolen her. The fact is, though, that Glory's scheme would probably have ended with her and some of the rest of us in jail, the baby back with its mother, and young Boughton under a tree somewhere, reading Huxley or Carlyle, his convertible at last restored to him. I don't know the right or wrong of a situation like that. I suppose we could have bought the child if we'd somehow managed to raise the money. But that's a crime, too. And those people had a sort of blackmail situation with the baby as hostage. If the Lord hadn't taken her home, it could have gone on for decades. Glory said, if we could have had her just 1 week. Then what, I wonder? I know exactly why she would have said that, but I wonder what it means. I have often thought the same about that other child of mine. Now they have penicillin, and so many things are different. In those days you could die of almost anything, almost nothing. We brought her shoes, Mrs. Boughton said. Why was she barefoot? The girl said, saving 'em. The poor little girl, her mother, she was white and sullen, about to die of sadness by the look of her. What to do with all the frustration and regret that builds up in this life? She had left school, and all we ever knew of her was that she ran off to Chicago. That's all I think I need to tell you about Jack Boughton. When his mother died, he didn't come home, as I've said. Maybe he wanted to spare us all having to deal with him. They loved that baby the way they did because they loved Jack so much. She looked just like him. And now here he is at home, and Glory as glad to be with him as if no shadow had ever fallen between them all. I have no idea why he is at home, nor do I know what reconciliation they have worked out among themselves. If my sermon had disturbed it, I would not feel equal to the regret that would have cost me. 20 years is a long time. I know nothing about those years, and I believe I would know, if anything had happened that redounded at all to his credit. He doesn't have the look of a man who has made good use of himself, if I am any judge. I've found a couple of my sermons under the Bible on the night table, which I take to mean that your mother recommends them to my attention. She has brought down a number of those sermons, fetched them down in the laundry basket, and she really is reading them. She says I should use some of them to spare myself effort that I might otherwise spend writing to you. That is a much more persuasive notion than her earlier one, that I should use them to spare myself effort. If I really thought I wasn't up to writing a sermon, I'd have to resign my pulpit. But the thought of having more time with you is a different thing altogether. One of the sermons is on forgiveness. It is dated June 1947. I don't know what the occasion was. I might have been thinking of the Marshall Plan, I suppose. I don't find much in it to regret. It interprets, "Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors," in light of the law of Moses on that subject. That is, the forgiveness of literal debt and the freeing of slaves every 7th year. And then the great restoration of the people to their land, and to themselves if they were in bondage, every 50th year. And it makes the point that, in Scripture, the one sufficient reason for the forgiveness of debt is simply the existence of debt. And it goes on to compare this to divine grace, and to the prodigal son, and his restoration to his place in his father's house. Though he neither asks to be restored as son, nor even repents of the grief he has caused his father. I believe it concludes quite effectively. It says, Jesus puts his hearer in the role of the father, of the one who forgives. Because if we are, so to speak, the debtor, and of course we are that too, that suggests no graciousness in us. And grace is the great gift. So to be forgiven is only half the gift. The other half is that we also can forgive, restore, and liberate, and therefore we can feel the will of God enacted through us, which is the great restoration of ourselves to ourselves. That still seems right to me. I think it is a sound reading of the text. Well, in 1947, I was almost 70, so my thinking should have been fairly mature at that point. And your mother would have heard me preach that sermon, come to think of it. She first came to church on Pentecost of that year, which I think was in May, and never missed a Sunday after it, except the one. It rained, as I have said, but we had a good many candles lighted, which has always been our custom for that service when we could afford them. And there were a good many flowers. And when I saw there was a stranger in the room, I do remember feeling pleased that the sanctuary should have looked as cheerful as it did, that it should have been such a pleasant place to step into out of the weather. I believe that day my sermon was on light, or light. I suppose she hasn't found it, or she doesn't remember it, or she doesn't think it was especially good. I'd like to see it, though. I do enjoy remembering that morning. I was 67, to be exact, which did not seem old to me. I wish I could give you the memory I have of your mother that day. I wish I could leave you certain of the images in my mind, because they are so beautiful that I hate to think they will be extinguished when I am. Well, but again, this life has its own mortal loveliness, and memory is not strictly mortal in its nature, either. It is a strange thing, after all, to be able to return to a moment when it can hardly be said to have any reality at all, even in its passing. A moment is such a slight thing, I mean, that its abiding is a most gracious reprieve. Once I went out with Glory to take some things to that little baby. The family lived just across the West Nishnabotna, and when we came to the bridge, we saw the two children, the baby and her mother, playing there in the river. We drove on to the house and set the food we had brought by the fence. We didn't approach the house because that pack of dogs came roaring out of the gate, and no one appeared to call them off. We always brought canned ham, canned milk, and so on, things the dogs couldn't get into. The little girl must have heard the car passing and the dogs barking and known that we had come to her house, since it was Monday. She would have ignored us if she did. She loyally reflected her father's view of us. She was offended by our concern and our helpfulness, and let us know as much by ignoring us as often as we gave her the chance. And I must say, I do not find that hard to understand. Her father clearly assumed that we were going to so much bother and expense in order to keep Jack out of trouble. And while no one ever said such a thing or even hinted at such an idea, I can't say he was altogether wrong. Nor can I say that it was no part of Jack's motive in confessing to his father that he knew poor old Boughton would respond to the situation as he did. That would explain why he left the Plymouth. In any case, Glory and I parked the car along the road 100 yards beyond the bridge and walked back and stood on the bridge and watched those children. The baby, who had just begun to walk, didn't have a stitch on, and the little girl was wearing a dress that was soggy to her waist. It was late summer. The river is very shallow at that time of year, and the bottom was half exposed and braided like water. There were sandbars right across, the bigger ones small jungles of weedy vegetation weedily in bloom, with butterflies and dragonflies attending on them like spirits. The little girl was practicing the maternal imperative from time to time, the way children sometimes do when they are playing. Maybe she knew she was being overheard. She was trying to dam a rivulet with sticks and mud, and the baby was trying to understand the project well enough to help. She would bring her mother handfuls of mud and handfuls of water, and her mother would say, "Now, don't you go stepping on it. You're just messing up all my work." After a while, the baby cupped her hands and poured water on her mother's arm and laughed. So her mother cupped her hands and poured water on the baby's belly, and the baby laughed and threw water on her mother with both hands